What if the thing you're listening to right now never got interrupted? What if it could play uninterrupted from room to room on Sonos? What if you start with two Sonos speakers just to see how it feels? What if you really like how it feels and you become a Sonos person who can't stop saying to their friends, "What if you start with two Sonos speakers just to see how it feels?" Because it's not magic, but it's not not magic.
Welcome back, folks. The Social Security trustees issue an annual report. They just released their annual report, and this year it's every bit as depressing as it is in most other years. And basically what it says is that things are getting worse. And here to describe how bad it is Romina Bhatia, Director of Budget and Entitlement Policy at the Cato Institute. Romina, welcome back to the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Romina, I would remind the audience that you have testified before Congress, correct me if I'm wrong, reminding them of just how bad the Social Security system truly is. But I got to ask you, is anybody listening? I mean, we're doing nothing.
Yes, Congress has held just these past 2 weeks, two hearings on Social Security, hearing from the trustees and the chief commissioner. And then just 2 days ago, there was another hearing in the Senate on the Social Security trustees report. And since then, a group of senators on a bipartisan basis have introduced a bill to establish an advisory process that would also force a potential vote in the Congress. You know, you see, the issue with Social Security is not that we don't know what we need to do to fix it. It's that there's no political will or courage to tackle what is arguably one of the most politically controversial programs in the United States, that's also highly popular with a very important voting constituency, seniors.
How much would they have to cut other programs being offered by the federal government in order to right the ship for Social Security?
Well, here's the challenge. If you wanted to just, if you didn't want to raise people's taxes to pay for Social Security, and if you didn't want to adjust Social Security benefits at all, and you just wanted to keep the gravy train going, and you said, let's cut other government programs and funnel that money into Social Security, just this year alone, you'd have to cut about $330 billion from the federal budget in order to cover the Social Security cash flow shortfall. But over the long term, in present value terms, so the amount of money you would need to invest today, the Social Security gap is actually almost as large as the entire publicly held debt at $30 trillion. And so it is a massive gap. And we should also ask whether, does it make sense to continue to subsidize retirements regardless of need at a time when our demographics have changed so significantly such that the burden on workers to finance this is becoming so large that it's impeding their ability to realize their version of the American dream? Because there are no savings in Social Security. It's a pure transfer from working Americans today to seniors with no investment taking place anywhere in the system.
And we're still trying to catch up for decisions that were made a decade ago or so about borrowing money from the Social Security Trust Fund when we were in the red. I mean, in the black as opposed to in the red, right?
Well, we had Social Security collect more payroll taxes than it needed to pay out in benefits from roughly 1983 to 2009. And during that time, the trust fund amassed about $3 trillion in surpluses. The issue is that the federal government doesn't save money. So when Congress saw that money come in, they thought up all kinds of ways that they could spend it, and they did. They ended up expanding Medicare. They added Part D. There were several rounds of tax cuts, all of which basically spent the Social Security surplus in other areas of the budget, with the Treasury writing an IOU to the Social Security Administration saying, hey, we're going to spend that money right now, but we're good for it. When you need it later, you come to us. Now that the Social Security Administration is knocking on Treasury's door and saying, hey, I got these IOUs, I need those now to pay out benefits, Treasury's going, oops, we have a $2 trillion annual deficit and we don't actually have the money coming in. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to issue more debt to repay you. And that's what's happening. And that's why it's not the necessarily the fault of the Social Security program with its dedicated payroll taxes, but it's the fact that the federal government as a whole doesn't have a policy of savings, and hasn't set aside the resources to actually cover those obligations.
But they knew then what they were doing, and they also knew that they were going to put this program in a predicament state, right? I mean, they had to know. I mean, math has no emotion.
That doesn't change dynamics, right? That's like, for Congress, they just want to give out benefits now, and they want to stick the next guy with the bill. That's how politics works.
So when we talk about remedial action, how deep does this have to go in order to right the ship? Because I never hear anybody talking, you know, anybody elected talking about that.
Yeah. Well, currently we're going from Social Security spending an average of about 4 to 4.5% of GDP to 6.5% of GDP. And so the program overall is becoming more expensive. The payroll tax at 12.4% is no longer sufficient to cover the cost. It would have to go up to about 17%, which is a huge increase for the average worker and would rob a median earner who only makes about $70,000 a year of more than $3,000 in additional taxes in order to avoid benefit reductions. I think that's too expensive for most workers and would significantly affect their ability to find and keep jobs because, as you know, employers also get stuck with about half of the payroll tax burden. So it'd be a shared burden here. Instead, we've heard proposals just this week by Senator Moreno and Warren. What if we eliminate the cap on Social Security taxes and make higher earners pay Social Security on all their earned income? Well, you bring in some more revenue in the near term, but in the big picture, you are going to put in place the largest marginal tax increase that the most successful, highly skilled professionals will face, the biggest tax increase in U.S. history, and many of those highly skilled workers, such as surgeons, physicians, engineers, pilots, are also at an age where it might incentivize them to retire early. So now you've created other problems. You're going to have less revenue coming in if a lot of those people decide to work less, and you might actually exacerbate shortages in medicine as well as among pilots. And so it's not really a good proposal. And even then, with all of that in mind, at best, you're going to close 30% of the long-term shortfall. So it's not a real solution. What we really need to do is reduce the growth of benefits, slow the growth in benefits. You don't even have to cut anyone's benefits, but we need to stop giving more and more generous benefits to every successive cohort. One of the biggest problems with Social Security is that what the program pays out doesn't actually reflect what people paid in or what they earned and what they paid taxes on. Instead, in 1977, Congress wanted to give individuals on Social Security a benefit increase. And so what they did is that they decided to index initial benefits for economy-wide wage gains. What we should be doing instead is acknowledge what people earn, what they paid in, and then adjust that amount for inflation. That would be fair and maintains their purchasing power. But when you give them a boost based on wage gains that have happened in the broader economy, where their wages from the 1980s, when they apply for Social Security in the 2020s, get adjusted upward as if they earned them in the 2020s at the current wage rates, that is unaffordable. And if you just eliminated that one policy, again, no benefit cuts, no tax increases, just slowing the growth of future benefits, you could close more than three quarters of the long-term shortfall. So that's really what we should be talking about.
I'm Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
And we have the podcast Office Ladies. Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing even more exclusive stories and lots of laughs.
Follow and listen to Office Ladies on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
And then they get a COLA, right?
Yes.
I mean, I just saw an announcement. I saw an announcement last year. Was it 1.9 or something? And this year was 2.1 or 2.2% COLA that they got. Am I incorrect in these numbers?
They were higher, and it's going to be higher this year because inflation is picking up again. But the thing with the COLA is for individuals who are already on Social Security, and it adjusts their benefits for inflation. But even that COLA is outdated. It's also from the 1970s. And we have a more modern, more accurate way to calculate inflation's effects on people's purchasing power now. That's another way that you could actually slow the growth in future benefits by adopting the so-called chain CPI for the current formula. It would be more accurate, and it would close the financing gap modestly.
So when you look into your crystal ball and understanding the political nature of this thing, it seems to me there's this willingness to just wait till there are no options before there's a decision made. Is that
yes,
a fair
Congress
characterization?
Congress likes to kick the can down the road for as long as they can. There is a statutory deadline that will come in 6 years in 2032 where the can hits the end of the road, and if it goes over the cliff, beneficiaries will be faced with a somewhere between a 22 and 25% benefit cut. So at the very latest, that's when I think we can expect political action, though hopefully we won't wait that long.
On a scale of 1 to 10, likelihood that we don't wait that long?
When you say, would the likelihood be the higher number would be a higher likelihood, then I'm going to say 8.
8? Okay.
I say
very optimistic.
We wait until 2032. I may be misreading the question, but I think it's
yes.
A very high likelihood, 80% that we wait until 2032.
To the bitter end is what you're saying, right?
That's right. I think there's a less than 20% chance that we're actually doing this before. You know what could cause it, though? A bond market revolt. If the bond markets went, we had enough, we're not doing this anymore, we don't trust you, inflation is coming, that might actually get Congress into shape.
I hope something gets Congress into shape. I know the frustration level that I have, the more I read about this, I love getting you on because you're on top of your game with this issue, and we appreciate that as well. But, I mean, this is ugly. It's getting uglier by the day. This is like student loan debt. You know, you owe more the next day than you did the day before. You know, it's just like getting worse every time you look at it. Romina Baccia, Director of Budget and Entitlement Policy at the Cato Institute. Thank you so much for joining us. Truly appreciate your time, your insight, and have a great weekend.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. We'll be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Art Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us.
Hey, what's up, flies? This is David Spade.
Dana Carvey.
Look, I know we never actually left, but I'll just say it. We are back with another season of Fly on the Wall.
Every episode, including ones with guests, will now be on video. Every Thursday, you'll hear us and see us chatting with big-name celebrities.
And every Monday, you're stuck with just me and Dana. We react to news, what's trending, viral clips.
Follow and listen to Fly on the Wall everywhere you get your podcasts.